You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, this is David Bryan, and you are watching or listening to, or both, Curiosity Invited. And today I have the great pleasure of speaking with Pamela Rosen, who is a licensed psychotherapist. And so welcome to Curiosity Invited, and how are you?
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
What do you want to say about your, you'll excuse the expression, your bio? You know, you are a licensed psychotherapist, but you are also a certified Hakomi therapist, and you do body work. And so you want to say anything about that in terms of how it relates to your work that as a therapist or not?
I've been working with clients and their bodies since 2003, first as a body worker, and mm-hmm. then I got trained in Hakomi, which is a body-oriented and mindfulness-based approach to psychotherapy. And I also weave in a history of acting and a lot of experientials. I taught theater in prison for a few years. Mm-hmm. And I have a vast teaching experience as well.
Does that work its way into your work as a clinical therapist? as a licensed psychotherapist.
Yes, I'd say I bring in all of my history into how I sit in the seat of therapist.
Yeah.
I really bring in the somatic element because I believe that the somatic psychotherapy element is like any psychotherapist, we deal with beliefs, thoughts, feelings. But a somatic psychotherapist is taking that one step further. And we're looking at how every cell of the body holds all of our memories of our past experiences. And so when we bring in mindfulness and awareness of the felt sensations in the body, we can start to become aware of how those past experiences are shaping how we move through the world.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah. Oh, good.
And that's where change is possible, I think, like when we drop into the deeper level of mindfulness and awareness of those felt sensations, that's when we can start to, one, see what are the core beliefs, and two, start to make a change for somebody.
And, I don't want to take things in a direction that will get us off whatever path, but do people who you work with have to believe the underlying assumptions that, like, for instance, that their body is holding, that the tissue is actually holding, for lack of a better term, critical information or historical information, psychological information. But for it to be successful, is it a required piece of the work?
Well, what comes to mind first is that a lot of clients will show up and they'll be resistant to it. They'll say, I know that I live in my head. I know that I'm very cognitive based, and it scares me to think of dropping into the body. And I think that fear, they know that there's some reason why they're drawn to work with me. They know that there's something there, and that they're probably scared to pull back that layer of the onion and see what awaits them. Mm-hmm. I think that there can be apprehension about the somatic aspect of my work. I don't think if they don't believe in it, they probably don't show up in my practice. Even if they're very resistant to it, I actually think that believing in the power, the potential power of whatever healing we're choosing, it's the belief is going to help the healing tremendously.
Right.
Because we see the world through our beliefs, we see the potential for possible change, we see the potential for a better world. When we can think it and imagine it in our mind, then we can create it. So I would say, yeah, a skeptic probably would not have as much success.
Wouldn't stay.
It wouldn't stay. They probably wouldn't show up either. Yeah,
got it. Well, so I know that some of because we had a conversation before this, that some of what you are working with on towards now is new ground, not just for you, but new ground, new territory, and that I know it has to do with working with people who were raised by parents, caregivers. Who grew up with parents, caregivers, who were diagnosed as having a borderline personality disorder. So,
and it may be that they goes undiagnosed. I want to say that.
Borderline personality
disorder, it's highly stigmatized, and it often goes undiagnosed. And I can say more about that. I'll let you complete your thought.
Well, no, could you talk a bit about what that even means, borderline personality disorder, and then you can dive into your work, can dive into your work.
Okay, I brought along a handy dandy chart. This chart shows the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, criteria for borderline personality disorder. So the first is abandonment reaction. The person will feel abandoned very easily and often. Idealization and devaluation. So they often see people and experiences in black and white. You're my best friend, and then suddenly you're my worst enemy. An unstable self-image. Impulsivity, and this can be self-damaging behaviors that can look like addictions. And the self-harm can look like recurrent suicidal behavior, self-harm. There can be cutting the wrists. Emotional instability is another one. So the person goes to high extremes of highs and lows, and it takes them a long time to come back to baseline. Chronic feelings of emptiness, inappropriate anger.
Isn't that just life? Chronic feelings of emptiness.
Yes, it is. And to meet, and so let me, the last one is paranoia and dissociation. And to meet a DSM criteria, the DSM diagnosis, you have to have 5 of the 9 criteria.
Got it.
So often people are not diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And this is in part because as a diagnosis, it is egosyntonic. So if I'm suffering from BPD, I don't see it as something separate from myself. I just see myself as victim, and I see the world as treating me poorly. I see that everyone else has a problem and it's not me. Versus as a psychotherapist, I see people and they're suffering from anxiety. They're suffering from depression. They see I'm a person, I'm intact, and I have something that is challenging for me. The egosyntonic, it's far more integrated into the beingness of the person. So folks with BPD will find a therapist. If they're suffering, they may find a therapist and fire that therapist very easily because they're like, oh, you're telling me things I don't want to hear.
Right.
So often people will find me because they're working with a therapist who has said, oh, by the way, I think your parent might suffer from borderline personality disorder. Or they've stumbled upon a group on Reddit or Facebook about people with BPD family members, and they've started to say, oh, wow, they're connecting the dots, and they're saying, now my childhood makes a lot of sense because I have this explanation for it.
But the person with borderline personality disorder, the parent, is not walking in the door to you. It's the caregiver, right? I mean it's the person who's been cared for. And are there common threads that one can discern for the people who were raised by people with borderline personality disorder?
Absolutely. So I definitely want to talk about attachment and how that play factors into this, but I'll answer your question in brief. Like, I think people will notice that it's impacting their relational patterns, the kind of relationships they're having. People with this wounding often, like, they spend a lifetime in therapy and find minimal change because their attachment with their parent was so tumultuous. And so they may notice in themselves that they have a lot of reactivity, that they have relationships that are very unstable themselves. They can notice it in a sensory way, like, I really need to control things in my environment in order to feel okay or in order to feel safe. And this can come down to, I need the lighting to be just so. I need fabrics against my skin to be soft. I need there not to be jarring sounds going on. A client who couldn't be in the therapy room because if there was a dryer running with a massage therapist in the next office. I could speak to, I created a little quiz for people to see, like, oh, what are things that might be happening for me that would be indications of that I might, you know, have grown up in a household with BPD.
Right.
So, it's hard to know what you want. It's hard to set boundaries for yourself. You've internalized a sense of shame or that you're bad. You anticipate being blamed for things. You feel like you're on edge a lot of the time and it's hard to relax. There might be tension in your body. It's hard to trust yourself. You're afraid to let people get close to you. You push yourself really hard to achieve in the world and you mask what's going on inside of you. So because you feel like you have to hold it together a whole lot. So you're hiding your genuine self.
Mm-hmm.
These are just some of the characteristics that someone who grew up with this wounding will then demonstrate in the world.
And you said that the people in that category raised by people with, they don't often have successful experiences in therapy.
Yes. So this is why I'm so excited, because I've created these therapy groups and this reparentive approach to therapy. That
reparentive, right?
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
Play on. It's a new word that I came up with, and I'm getting it trademarked. And it's the merging of a few concepts. So in a concept in therapy is reparenting, and that's often what a therapist is doing. But my concept is a quality that the therapist embodies, and it's about reparations. It's about making up for qualities that were lacking in the parent. So this is a way of being that the therapist shows up and embodies qualities of repair, and I'm available for repair. I'm humble, transparent. I support the autonomy and individuation of you as client, as if you were my child. I am focused on the positive and resilience and seeing your resilience, non-pathologizing. There's qualities of predictability, qualities that were lacking in the parent. Mm-hmm. So these are the qualities that a reparentive therapist embodies in order to offer the client an experience of something that was missing in their childhood. Yeah. Yeah. And by providing this in a therapeutic setting and offering the client a chance to really become mindful of their own body and take in this missing experience, then they can have a nourishment from the relationship, and actually it can go to repair something that was lacking in their childhood.
You said, use the word transparent. So
transparency in, if clients want to know why are we doing this in this activity and group, I'll say, well, here's my goal, and this is what I want for you, and this is what I'm hoping that you get to explore and become aware of, a core belief, a way of organizing. I'm going to be really transparent in that way,
mm-hmm.
predictable in, like, we're going to have predictable structure to how we move through group and how we move through the therapy. I am transparent because I believe that we get wounded in relationship, and it's through relationship that repair is possible. So if clients have a question about me, I'm not going to be completely an open book, but I'm going to let them know like that. I let them know that this is my story too. Like I'm doing this work because I've been through this experience. I will share things if it helps build safety for the client. Mm-hmm. I really believe in transparency in that way.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to really teach the therapists to do who are going to continue to lead my groups.
And that's the other piece that is unique, different about this, is that you're not just describing how you work with clients. You are now launching a group to train other therapists because you have some sort of a protocol or a procedure or a something. I don't know if I'm using the right word, but that you found to be successful in this, and now it's about putting this out there in the world for other therapists, because you know it's just 24 hours in the day, and you're only one person.
Exactly. Yeah. So since 2019, I've been leading a therapy group that I created called Growing Ourselves Whole. And it's a 10-week journey through turning over many of the stones of this wounding, on the unpredictability and the emotional volatility, setting boundaries, knowing what we want, looking at how this wounding affects us in our current life, looking at our parents' history. So I've created this group, and it's been hugely successful. And the changes that the clients are reporting, I had a client say that they found a peace that their ancestors could not have envisioned through this group. I had another client say that I can see past the trauma to the person I am. Another quote was that there's more space for the love because the shame is getting smaller. Mm-hmm. Like just, I get chills just naming all this. Like the successes that I'm seeing in my clients is just amazing. And that in the arc of these 10 weeks that they get a window into a different way of relating to themselves and to other people, they get to experience this group as a reparative family experience. And because let me just finish this. Because I've led it so many times, and I've seen that this work needs to get out to a wider audience. And so now I have a training that begins this March where therapists located anywhere in the world can come and study how to lead this 10-week group and learn from me this technique that I've pioneered called reparentive therapy. Mm-hmm. And learn the 10 principles of the reparentive therapy, and then I have a list of 9 buckets of healing. Like the buckets are what guide us and what we want the clients to keep putting into all these 9 buckets. And I can tell you about what the 10 principles and the 9 buckets.
But then you have to kill me because it's not yet it's not yet protected. It's 10 particular weeks, right? And you obviously are going to present them in some sort of sequential order. Have you run into situations where, you know, person A goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, it's just fine. The other person is 1, but really 7 should come next. And then 2, it's like, are people unique? People are unique, and so are they so unique that a person has to be skilled at juggling all sorts of different sizes of balls?
That's an interesting question. I have feedback forms at the end of each group, and the feedback has been that the flow and the pace, and I haven't really gotten feedback on the sequence, but honestly, I've created this group to be an ideal group for me if I were the participant. And I think the flow builds on safety from 1 week to the next. Mm-hmm. So build to a certain level of intimacy, and then we share stories about our childhood. And I also have built the structure of every evening so that the clients arrive, we are guided into mindfulness, and then there's a journaling prompt, and then we do a check-in. Mm-hmm. We explore the theme of the evening, often with a brainstorm of what are the messages and what are the beliefs that we might have internalized based on these messages that we got in our childhood home. And then we'll do an experiential exercise. So I put them in breakout rooms and there'll be a chance to test out how it feels in the body. And then we debrief as a whole.
And I'm just wondering, I know you've spoken to some people, but have you shared your work enough with other therapists to get a sense? Have you run into responses that are oh, that's really unique or different from what I've done, and maybe that would be successful, or you know, ho hum, been there, done that.
No, I'm definitely getting that first response. I mean, I have therapists. I pretty much every time I mention to a therapist that I've created this group, I hear, wow, that is so needed. Thank you for working with this population. Thank you for doing the work you do. And many therapists are like, can I sign up for your group?
Is it likely that, you know, a potential client walks in the door to, you know, test out a therapist, and a therapist says, you need help, I'm not the person, find somebody else, because will people avoid this population because it's too hard or it's too something?
Yeah, I want to say this with like so much love and respect for people that are in this system of wounding, because the like BPD is born of a lot of trauma and it's passed down the generations, and the parent has a lot of trauma and the adult child as a result grew up with a lot of trauma. And so some of these difficult patterns of relating can come out in the therapeutic relationship. So if I grew up with a borderline parent, hypothetically, and I go to see you as a therapist and I don't feel safe, I might need things to be a particular way. I might get angry at you very easily. I might feel abandoned by you very easily. All of the challenges that these people bring to every relationship are going to show up in the therapeutic relationship. And so one of the ways that I'm working with the therapists in the training is about the what we call counter-transference. Like, what comes up for you in the seat of therapist when you sit with this person? How do you, especially a very big tool that I'm working with is nervous system regulation. How do I, as therapist, ground myself so that I can be available, I can be a tree that flexes with the winds of the tumultuous energy that's coming at me from this client or circle of clients. And nervous system regulation is key also to this conversation, because I speak about co-regulation a lot. And in an ideal parenting scenario, the parent provides the container and offers the child soothing so that the child learns to manage distressing emotions that arise for them. So this is an ideal co-regulation scenario in parenting. When we're talking about a parent with borderline personality disorder, we're talking about someone who's ill-equipped to regulate their own nervous system. They don't have a sense of self. They don't have that to provide to the child. So the child grows up, for one, having to be in the role of parent in a lot of ways, and with a nervous system that's never been regulated by another person. And so one of the key qualities that my therapists learn is how to be that regulated, calm nervous system, so that my clients showing up dysregulated can come and drink from my well. Mm-hmm. I have water to give them.
Okay, so you don't have to answer this question, but why did you end up there? Why did you end up in this?
I'll say that like this is my experience, and I was motivated on a path to healing my own heart, healing my own trauma, and I years ago created a peer group of people with this history as well. And doing it in a circle and a group was revolutionary, because you can sit with an individual therapist and the therapist can offer you empathy, but the therapist doesn't go saying, oh, well, I lived through this as well, and this is my story. But when you get a circle of people together, the sharing of stories and the relating and the shared inspiration from seeing someone else with that history as well, I mean, it's really amazing. And so because I'd had this group experience, it's part of what set me off on the journey to becoming a therapist, to then be able to provide this to other people wounding this history.
Got it. Thank you.
And I'd never expected it to be this successful, that I keep gathering more clarity about what this population needs. And I keep like fine tuning how is it that I sit that's going to be in the reparative way, and what are the experiential exercises they're going to help these clients bring the core beliefs to the conscious level, so that then they can have some choice. They can see what are the beliefs that are shaping how I move through the world.
Yeah.
And my clients are so grateful that I'm someone who says, I get it. Mm-hmm. I'm you. I'm on this journey as well. I'm on this path.
But without revealing anything that you don't want to reveal, I'm curious if any of your clients have spoken about, so they've spoken about felt sense of relief, improvement, richness, betterment, ease for themselves. Have any of them talked about their relationship with whoever it was that their parent or caregiver has improved or has changed because of what they feel, because of what they're getting from being in the group?
Yeah. So in the arc of the 10-week group, I generally have people who are no contact and people who are in contact with their parent. So they sort of fall in these two camps. Mm-hmm. And so I can't really speak to a big shift happening, but like I have an ongoing level 2 of people who've done my level 1, and I have several people who are in individual therapy with me who've done my groups. And so I see people experimenting with new ways of being. Mm-hmm. And I don't hold an agenda that they reach forgiveness necessarily, right, that they be in contact with their parent necessarily. I want them to cultivate a relationship with their internalized parent, with their kind voice inside them. That's the most important shift. That's such an important thing. And then they may find that they go no contact, and that's an evolution for them.
Mm-hmm.
Say, like, I know the parents' messaging throughout their life is, don't leave me. Don't individuate. Don't separate. And so to take a stand and say, I'm actually going to go no contact, that might be the way that the client finds that they find the most expansion and deep breath in their body. And that's where they're most alive. And I'm all for that. I'm all for them finding whatever works best for them.
And is it exhausting work? Or is it invigorating? Because when you're speaking about it, you are, maybe this is just an act, but wait, as you speak about it, you're sort of lighting up and you're enthusiastic about it, and it feels very enlivening.
I'm genuine in my, like, I am energized by this. Like, I feel really in alignment with a deep sense of purpose. Like, this is my calling, that I can't stop or help myself from doing this. I have to do this work. I tried to write this on the
website. Have you ever had this feeling before?
No, I don't think I have. I'm like this right here. I've been passionate about work that I've done in the past.
Yeah.
I was passionate when I was a massage therapist. I was like, this is my calling. But right now I'm really like very clear that this is my calling. This needs to be born. And every time I end the Zoom session, I'm like, yes, this right here, because I'm sitting in the room witnessing change. I'm witnessing people experience and take in safety and love and care for themselves. I'm hearing people who've had a sense of isolation say, I think I'm so messed up, but I look around the room and I see all of you, the virtual room, I see all of you that are, they're saying, if you've survived this, I must be able to, and I must be okay that I've made it to this place that I'm at. Yeah. And I just like seeing that, then hearing people say that they feel less alone, that they often, they're like, I'm so sorry that you've lived through this as well, but I feel so much less alone. And then they move through their life and things and shifts are happening. Like change starts to happen.
You're doing something that calls attention to people being aware of their bodies. And at the same time, it is successful on Zoom. And maybe we're now all so familiar with Zoom, we should all just sort of course. But that seems different.
Okay, I want to speak to this, though, because I am really over Zoom in so many ways. I'm really fed up with it. And we've been subjected to way too much. And so...
It's at least ironic that we're...
It's ironic. Saying let's use the body. But yeah. I say to my groups, all right, I want this time to be set apart from the rest of your day. You get to bring in whatever fuzzy blankets and warm tea and pretend I'm there making you tea as if I were there in the room with you. We're going to be really experiential. It's going to be very interactive. I am like a kinesthetic person. And so I also want the learning to come in many different avenues for them. And also, I'm going to bring awareness to, like, this is our I-band. We hold a lot of vigilance in this area. Let's do a somatic exercise to release the eyes. Mm. Let's do a somatic exercise that you can bring into your day. And when you have to be on a Zoom meeting with your boss, you can be doing this isometric muscle exercise where you feel containment and it's off screen, but now you have a resource. So let's bring the body in moments when it's actually not welcomed. I want you to have a massage ball that you put under your feet. So you're remembering that you have a body, even in those moments when you're being called into vigilance.
Yeah.
Especially through my training, like I'm going to train therapists located anywhere to weave in these techniques and weave in reparative qualities that they, yes, the how I'm suggesting it's most ideal to work with this population in a group format. And the reparative qualities that I teach my therapists are applicable to any therapeutic dyad or working with a couple or et cetera. You can bring in the qualities of creating the field of love and safety and being predictable and my list of 10 qualities.
So not to put you on the spot, but it occurs to me, so like so many other things, you know, some people are really good at it and some people are not as good at it. And so is there some sort of a screen? Can you talk about like, how are you going to pick people for this group? I mean, they're going to contact you, but it's like at some point it's either thumbs up or thumbs down, right?
I mean, yeah, totally. So I already have a few people that are interested in the program, and I have some applications, and so the process has begun. And one of my key questions for the therapists is exactly about the counter transference, and I always want to know. So how are you at sitting with what arises in you when you're with clients, and how much are you doing your own work? So it's very likely that the therapists that are showing up for my training, and so far the therapists that are showing up for my training know this wounding intimately. And so the paradox is that someone with this wounding is likely to draw clients who, if this is just, it just happens this way energetically, and it's also how we put our messaging out to the world. Like, I work with developmental wounding, chronic developmental trauma, et cetera. Some of those kinds of things will draw clients that have this background. So my work with the therapist is very much to see, like, how good are you at not getting hooked? And so that I can also support you to not get hooked by these clients. I also think it's a self-selecting thing that thus far in my groups, every time I've screened for the therapy groups, a small fraction of people are not ready for it yet. Mostly the people that reach for it are ready for it. Occasionally I have to say, listen, I think I'd like you to have more individual therapy and work on these things before you're ready for my group. Or perhaps I recommend that they do dialectical behavioral therapy, which is an amazing approach that is designed specifically to work with people with patterns of borderline personality disorder in themselves or in their family history. I actually think that, I'll tell you more about it, DBT therapy, I think it should be taught in schools because it's so fantastic.
So could you talk more about this dialectic behavioral therapy?
Sure. So dialectical behavioral therapy was founded by Marsha Linehan, who is a therapist who suffered in the past. She's still alive, but she suffered from BPD herself. And dialectical is talking about two things in relation to each other. And so in the mind of someone with BPD, there really can only be black or white. And DBT is teaching skills of mindfulness, distress tolerance, interpersonal communication effectiveness. I'm not remembering all elements of it, but it's taught in these 8-week modules. And it's a lot about, like, how do I calm my nervous system? How do I regulate my own emotions? How do I interact in effective ways with other people? So these are skills for folks with BPD to learn how to interface with their environment more effectively. And it leads to emotional, like, freedom and happiness and getting more of what we want, basically.
If it's leading to those things, why does somebody need to come to a group? Why isn't that sufficient? Dialectic behavioral therapy, why isn't that sufficient? Because it sounds like what you're talking about is that they learn to regulate themselves and they learn to kind of calm themselves and blah, blah, blah. I don't mean blah, blah, blah in a dismissive way.
Yeah.
So why isn't that enough?
Right. So you're saying, why is my group necessary
if
everyone could just go to DBT?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that what they're getting from my group is the content of the shared stories and the actual, like, somatic experiential experiments. So we're going to do an experiment of what happens in your body when something catches you by surprise and you're back in something that reminds you of the unpredictability of your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to become conscious of why you're emotionally dysregulated often and what's happening inside you. So it's like DBT is broadly like, how do you regulate your own emotions? How do you interface with the world? And it's very much skills based.
Mm-hmm.
And my group is, okay, let's be nine humans, including therapist, in the room together. Let's really track our own nervous systems and our bodies. Let's talk about what has been shamed in the past, because our past was locked up in shame and darkness, and you were not meant to speak about what went on behind closed doors. Let's shine the light of love and empathy and compassion, and let's actually talk about these things that were held in the darkness. And that's when, like, amazing change happens. And that's not happening anywhere that I know of.
Is shame a big feature of this particular thing that we've been talking about?
Yeah, it's really, really big. So someone with BPD lives with such a sense of emptiness and shame inside their body, and it's intolerable. And so they're very eager to put that on somebody else. And they often are charismatic out in the world, but their family members suffer greatly because there's a constant zero-sum game. There always has to be someone who's right and someone who's wrong. So I'm going to constantly blame you. If you're in my line of fire, you're going to get blamed for how hard my life is, often. And so if you're my child and you're constantly blamed for how hard my life is, what you're going to internalize a sense of it must be my fault. Everything must be my fault. And you're going to translate that into how you move through the world as an adult, where you're going to anticipate before anyone blames you, you're going to already know, just have this deep inner sense of I'm to blame for this. So the clients that show up in my practice and in my groups are completely carrying the weight of this heavy blame and shame that they've been burdened with.
Mm-hmm.
So that our work is very much like, how do you start to love yourself? How do you start to name some of these things? How do you start to bring to the conscious level these beliefs that were encoded in you?
Much earlier you spoke about, so I just asked you about shame, and it seems to be a feature of this. And much earlier you mentioned attachment, and how does that play a role both in the parent and in the person who was raised by that parent?
It's so clear that we are shaped by our primary relationship with the person, the our caretakers. And this happens throughout the whole time we're in connection with them, but in particular, the first 5 years of life are essential in shaping how we interface with the world. And we have five survival systems, five innate reactions that we utilize all the time in response to stimuli. We can fight, flight, freeze, attach, and submit. And so the system of attachment is something I want to speak about for a moment. So we're the most dependent creatures on the planet. We need contact as a necessity for our survival. And this bond is essential for our development of ourselves. Like who we are, who you are today, and like your ability to respond to stress. It's like super, our ability to get connection is essential. So when our parents' capacity to give that to us is impaired, we will do whatever we can to basically to get connection from our parent and get connection. So even when the wounding is very profound from the parent, our need for attachment, we adapt in creative ways. So often another of our reactions will get braided into our attachment system. So if love and fighting are presented in my childhood home, I will understand love and connection means fighting. So I will go and seek out, or I will go and create fighting in my relationships, in my work relationships, in my intimate relationships, all around. But that's because that's how I've learned to get connection. It could be that I preference submitting and surrendering my sense of self in order to get connection, because also that was what I learned for survival in my childhood home. So I will be like, oh, I don't know, what do you want to do? That is another alternative. So I think that healing from these lacking attachment bonds is the core of what I'm trying to do. And what we're trying to do with psychotherapy is to heal those early attachment ruptures. Because in an ideal parenting scenario, the parent is absolutely able to show up and offer a good attachment bond and be available to the child's needs. But for so many reasons, the parent might not be. There could have been a divorce happening or a death in the family or some other reason that the parent isn't able to show up for the child. And so then the child develops all these adaptive responses.
Mm-hmm. It all sounds hard and important.
I have a fun little example that I just want to do a little show and tell. Okay, so can you see these?
I do.
Do you remember them? I grew up in the 70s. These were Weebles. There was a whole ad called Weebles
Wobble, but they don't fall down.
Yes. Okay. But I came up with it with a client, the image of a Weeble, because when you have a parent with BPD, doing, you're used to just popping back up again, like nothing phases you. Boom, boom, boom. You're always resilient, optimistic, like ignoring the fact that you've been knocked down so many times. And what I talk the clients through is like, what is it about this Weeble that enables it to keep popping back up again? What would you say enables this to keep popping back up again?
This round underbelly.
Yeah, and it's weighted here.
Yeah, probably. Right?
So this is all part of maybe the shame or the blame or the grief that hasn't been integrated.
Why isn't it good? You get to be resilient.
To be resilient.
Well, you learn to be resilient.
I know resilience is always a good thing. But if I'm just a little round guy with no, you know, limbs, I don't integrate the darker pieces that are in the subconscious and that are about my adaptive strategy to my parent. And so that's part of one of my ways of working with clients is let's look at all of the parts. Let's look at what might be outside of our conscious awareness.
So you've developed a protocol, you've developed an approach, and it's, is there territory in what you are working with where you feel like it's, some places are far more developed, you feel far more certain about this aspect and this aspect of what you're doing, and others that you feel like there's still territory to be mined, to perfect it, to craft it, to, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm trying to feel into how to answer this. I think I've been guided by this is working and do more of this. And so I'm incorporating feedback from the groups, but as I realized that I need to take this out to a wider audience and to train therapists in doing this, I'm just following like the information that I get from how it's going and what I see that I'm bringing that's unique in the work that I don't see anywhere else. I don't see this happening in other places. So I don't know. I don't know what I don't know yet. And I'm an explorer. I'm following what's working.
And are there other territories that you are? Territories. I'm so. This territory is BPD. The effect of BPD on a population of offspring. And are there other territories that are sort of calling to you, or of interest to you, that are, ooh, I wonder if.
Well, for one, I am calling it wounding from a parent with BPD. And it's a very long title, and it's very complex, you know, very, very narrow niche. And yet I think that a lot of other people would fall into the need for reparative therapy. Mm-hmm. As I go and develop language for it, I think I'm going to welcome a lot more people into this training and into these groups, because I think that it's will serve more than just folks with.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I suspect, right, it has a much broader.
Yeah.
A much broader application.
Yeah, and trauma is always, like, the same event can be experienced very differently in different people.
Yeah.
And so that, I mean, traumas live in people's bodies very differently. And I think it also has to do with how, if someone is given secure attachment early on, then they'll respond well. And if there is something lacking in their attachment, then in those early years, they'll be more susceptible to trauma. And so it might, to answer what you're saying, it might not be that someone meets the criteria for a diagnosis.
Right.
They still might need reparative therapy, yes.
Right, absolutely. Right. Somebody's parent might not meet that diagnosis. And so the children may not have the panoply of wounds, but boy, do they have this one, because that one really, you know, because of their constitution, because the parent was really good at being really bad at this particular thing. And so I suspect it sounds like the approach, when it is the right approach for certain things, it seems to have the possibility of far more applicability than it may not be narrow, but then this particular thing, you know, offspring of parents who. So, well, thank you.
To respond to that, it is going to be exciting to see how this evolves, because and actually I could use an image from the Hakomi approach to psychotherapy. It's far less of like, I have a map and I'm going to guide you as therapist, than let's jump in together, mm-hmm. therapist and client. Far more like a shaman guiding, like, let's take the medicine together and let's see where this unfolds. Mm-hmm. And so I'm being in relationship to reparentive therapy and to my work as like, it's all an experiment. I'm gathering information. I'm seeing who needs this. How does it need to evolve and change? What's the next step? I'm trying to also listen to spirit and hear like what's wanting to be born here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's because you're from California.
I'm so woo. I am from California. Sorry.
You're very down to earth for a woo-woo person.
I know. It's because I was born a New York Jew, but now I got the California woo. So it's like a bit of all of it is mixed together here.
Been there, done that. Brooklyn. I mean, okay. Really New York, you know.
Yeah. And then you were in Southern California, right?
Yeah.
And Santa Cruz.
I was in both Southern California for years and then Santa Cruz, yeah.
Come on, that's like Santa Cruz. That's some...
Yeah, that's... That'll make a person...
To make sure you know who you're on the phone with when you're calling people.
Yes.
Brooklyn,
Santa Cruz. Brooklyn, Los Angeles, Santa Cruz, Wyoming.
Wyoming.
Yeah. So you really have to... Make sure you know who's on the phone. Well, Pamela Rosen, thank you so much for being willing to talk about your work. It sounds, as I say, it sounds both challenging and important, and you make it sound like it's delightful, and I know it is nonetheless hard work. And thank you, and I wish you the best of luck. And who knows, you know, I mean, as this morphs, maybe you'll be back. Maybe we'll be really curious again.
That would be great. Thank you so much for having me, David.
Oh, welcome.
Thanks. You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.